Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello everybody, here's a new episode of the podcast. This one is sponsored by Audible, the world's top provider of downloadable audiobooks. And if you'd like to download a free audiobook of your choice from their massive library, then go to audibletrial.com/teacherluke or just click an Audible logo on my website. So here's a new episode featuring a conversation with a friend of mine who originally comes from the Netherlands, but he's lived all over the world. And you're going to hear us talking about cultural differences, Dutch stereotypes, doing business in France, the UK and the USA, the different communication styles in those places, doing stand-up comedy and getting Darth Vader's signature. I hope that you enjoy listening to this as much as we enjoyed recording it. And here's the jingle. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. What I'm going to do is not an introduction, because normally at the beginning of this sort of thing, there's me saying, hello, welcome to another episode of the podcast. How are you doing? I hope you're well. Welcome to another episode. And then I do a long rambling introduction. And then the episode starts, and then typically you hear me introducing it again with the guest there. But I'm just going to skip out the whole first part
okay. And
just go straight into the introduction now. So welcome to the podcast, everyone. This is one of those episodes where I have a conversation with a friend of mine, and we just kind of ramble on about various things. And this is just a chance for you to listen to real English as it actually happens. And with me today, I have Alexander Van Walsum. Hello, Alex.
How do you do? That's for the audience. I figured that was a nice British-y thing to say.
Yeah, very nice.
How do you do?
Yeah, and they're all saying, hello, how do you do? Because that's the response to how do you do, isn't it? It's not, because people...
Isn't it how do you do what?
How do you do? How do you do what?
How do I do what?
How do you drive a car?
I had an English friend in Washington, D.C., and we went to a place to get some takeout. No.
Takeaway.
Yeah, takeaway. He knows about, what do they call it in England? Takeaway.
Takeaway.
Right, and the lady said, you want that to go? And he said, go where? He just didn't know that.
He's like, go home, right? Well, yeah, I just ordered a takeaway. So, hello, Alex. Welcome to the podcast. How does it feel to be on Luke's English podcast?
I think it's my first podcast.
Is it your first ever podcast?
That I've been on one.
Really?
I haven't even tried to make one. So yeah, it's my first podcast.
First podcast. Welcome to the world of podcasting.
Thank you.
Anyone can do it.
Hello, everyone.
And the world is going... like that. That's the sound of the world.
Luke just did that with his mouth. That wasn't even a button or something. He just did something with his mouth. He knows how to work
sound
a mic.
Sound effects.
All right.
Yeah, that's right. You get the full experience. So I guess my first question for you, Alex, is how do we know each other?
We know each other from the huge Paris stand-up scene, where the world's greatest comedians who perform in English all perform.
Yeah, that's right. It's one of the biggest comedy scenes in the world.
But there's something nice about having a comedy scene in Paris, because if you really wanted to get really good at comedy, you'd probably have to go to New York or London or Los Angeles or tour. Mm-hmm. Try to get on nights. And here, there's just not enough people, so we get to go on all the time.
That's right, yeah.
And once you're done with doing the stand-up, you're in Paris.
Right.
So you get to be in Paris and always do that stand-up thing you wanted to do.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, we're very lucky. And people come. People actually come to see it.
Yeah.
You got some expats, missing home and that whole thing. And then you got all this whole new generation of French people who see all their TV shows in version originale and suddenly speak English.
Right.
Compared to that previous generation, those 68ards, the 68 people who could speak English but didn't want to speak the language of the imperialists kind of thing.
How do you feel the French are with English these days then? Do you think they're getting better?
Oh, yeah. Ever since they were able to... Well, because people sometimes say, wow, you Dutch all speak English really well.
Because you're Dutch.
Because I'm Dutch. Sorry, yeah, I'm Dutch, and I'm a different case. But the Dutch who speak English with a bit of an accent, they have since childhood seen all their TV in VO, in original whatever language it was in.
Yeah,
so they'll see anything in English in English, and German shows in German. And I think it's just because there's not enough actors to dub everything. It's such a small place. And now in France, you have this whole new generation that just sees, they have the internet, they have Netflix, they have, even before, if they had cable, they were able to push a button and see it in its original version. So I think now there's a whole generation of French people that, it's like I always tell, any French people I tell who are reluctant to speak English, I just tell them, listen, you don't have to learn English to speak to the English.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn it to speak to the Chinese or to the Swedes.
Yeah.
That's the language we all use to speak to each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just like this thing that everyone sort of has to have a part of, you know, and that includes different accents and things too, you know, different versions of English. But the Dutch are in Europe very good at English, and they seem to be very good at languages, which is quite interesting because you're there, you know, sort of right in the middle of Europe, there's France and Germany and, you know, these other countries. But for some reason, the Dutch have kind of just really nailed languages, in my experience.
Who's going to learn Dutch? I mean, seriously, no one's ever running off to their Dutch lessons, you know? I'm late for my Dutch class, gotta go. You know, have you heard Dutch?
I've heard, it's sort of lots of sounds.
Yeah, it sounds like an Arab speaking German with a throat infection. You know, it's just all, everything has a ch in it. That's why we have these canals in Amsterdam. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, so when we talk, it's just all spit.
That's right.
And it's a small country. There's not a lot of us. We speak Dutch, and then there's some people in South Africa who speak some kind of Dutch that went off on its own after 1652,
yeah.
I think, 53. They just stayed there and said, all right. And so they, when you can kind of speak to them, but they're those apartheid people. We don't want Afrikaners. It's so like, no one's learning Dutch.
Okay.
And as a small country, you step out of the wrong side of bed and suddenly you're in Germany or Belgium. And uh-huh. And I think in schools, they make you learn it too. But I didn't grow up in Holland. I'm cheating.
No, because you speak with this American accent.
Because...
I mean, there's no trace of a Dutch accent in your voice, I think.
Right. I think we arrived in, my family was in New York when I was 3 or 4 years old. And then they moved around after that. Parents got divorced. I suddenly had a Brazilian stepfather, so he didn't learn Dutch.
How many stepfathers?
One.
Oh, yeah.
But
A Brazilian, sorry. I thought you said a gazillion.
A gazillion, no. We had so many stepfathers. My mom just kept marrying diplomats. But
right.
My father was a career Brazilian. Diplomat.
Right.
And then my stepfather's a Brazilian diplomat, so we were never in our home countries. Well, at one point, we were in my stepfather's home country, and that was Brazil, where I went to an American school.
Right.
So they kept my sister and I in the same... relatively the same education system, going from one international school to another. Sometimes it was called the International School of like Brussels or the American School of The Hague. Even when I was 6 months living actually in Holland, I went to an American school.
Okay. So wait a minute. How many different places have you lived in then?
About like eight.
Really? So there's the USA, there's the Netherlands.
I was born in Paris by chance.
You were born in Paris?
My parents were here when I was born.
Wow.
And I was so...
So there's Brazil as well, and Belgium.
Paris, Romania. My sister was born in Romania, and then we were in New York. Then my parents split up, and my mother and stepfather and I and my sister went to Switzerland. My father went to India, so we would be shuttled between the mm-hmm. two. Basically, 3 or 4 months out of the year, we'd be in wherever my father was living,
mm-hmm.
and he'd be always in somewhere like India or Bangkok or something. So,
right,
just yeah.
Okay, bloody hell!
That's where English worked everywhere. So, to all your listeners, English is the key. It's the maybe more people speak Mandarin, but they're not all over the place.
So, did you actually grow up speaking Dutch as a first language or English?
Both. Yes. We kept the Dutch up by every now and then, every year, going back to Holland for vacation, seeing relatives.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were the cool kids from the States. I even convinced a cousin of mine that in America, everybody gets to go to the moon. Like, what? You don't go to the moon? What the fuck? Like, that was a normal thing.
Right.
And there we spoke Dutch, and my grandmother would send us cartoons in Dutch, comic books in Dutch, like Tintin and
right.
Asterix and Disney stuff. It was in Dutch, so we'd keep up the Dutch.
Right.
And I guess my mom must have talked to us along the way, but at home, we around the table, we'd all... My stepfather didn't learn any Dutch.
He so just it was other, English.
So it was all English. We would speak English at home from a very young age. So I am not the right classic example of what to do when you learn English, but I do advise, if you can go to these places where they speak English and spend time with people who speak English, that's really the best thing, obviously.
Yeah. But a lot of people can't do that, so they have to kind of... they have to listen to Luke's English podcast, obviously.
Obviously.
But also the thing you were talking about before about the sort of younger French generation who are now sort of connecting with English on the internet and using things like movies and Netflix and stuff and podcasts, you know?
I saw a headline and even adopting the English internet jargon into French language. Like I saw a headline that said something like Les comédienne or les rôles, something, some Hollywood roles or actresses who were les plus badass. And it just said, the whole sentence was in French. And then, I mean, it was BuzzFeed France, but I guess there's no word for badass in.
I guess it's become one of those international words, isn't it? Badass.
Mauvais cul.
It doesn't sound quite
mauvaise
right.
Mauvaise fesse. No.
Doesn't sound
it's
quite right.
To go with badass. So it's just, seems to be a sort of internet English.
Yeah.
That is,
Internet English. I don't know. Internetlish. I don't know what it would be called. Nintendo. No, that's something else.
We're all one, man.
Yeah, exactly. Right, so we know each other from doing comedy here in Paris, which is not the largest comedy scene in Europe or anything. It's obviously a very small scene. But, it's been sort of slowly kind of developing over the last 5 years or something. And, we've got someone like Sugar Sammy here now, and he's performing in English. And Louis C.K. came here and did his stuff in English.
And that was Louis C.K.
That was Louis C.K. in the background. And so, the scene is sort of coming along. So what about stand-up then? How did you get into doing stand-up here?
Well, they let me. That was the first.
Who's they?
They. So at first there was one stand-up night. You remember it was Sebastian Marx's New York Comedy Night, and it was it was an open mic night, so you could go up there with your notes and just kind of try it out.
Yeah.
Then
Rob Hain came along.
Yeah. You know, then it expanded, but I remember that the first time I did it, it was it's one of those things you always think seeing stand up people do it, you think, God, I wish I could do that, and then later you think, maybe I could do that.
Yeah.
And you find yourself standing around friends and saying something, and then suddenly everybody laughs. You're like, wait, that's you guys like that? Yeah, I'm going to just write that down. And then suddenly you have, I guess, material.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was like I've only been doing it for about, how long have you been doing it here?
I've been doing it here for 4 years.
Yeah, I think so. I think I started the first time about three, four years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah.
And it was like, I stood up in front of an audience and told jokes before in advertising.
Right.
Because I'm by day,
yeah.
Comedian by night, and by
advertiser,
copywriter by day, and on the creative side. So we sometimes have to go stand up in front of clients and present basically jokes in 30 seconds or a headline on a on a poster or something, and they wouldn't laugh because they didn't like it, and you're just. But normally we were presenting something funny. They would have to meet amongst each other before, or the younger clients wouldn't dare express themselves until the older client, the more senior guy had expressed what he felt. So they're all,
they're also consulting each other. Like you tell a joke, and they're like, "So what did you think? Was it funny? What was the punchline?"
But not only that, they're not just there to see if it's funny. They've got all sorts of other things on their mind, like market share and, and sometimes the wife, I've had a client, the wife didn't like it in the end. They had a meeting, it was, okay. And then the wife didn't like it and came back, we got to do it over. Because some superstition she had. It was like...
Terrible audience. Imagine a stand-up audience like that. So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You tell your joke and they're like, is that funny? Calling their wives.
Is it on strategy?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it... going to speak to our target. They're thinking about other things. So it was like I'd been doing stand-up in quicksand.
Right.
So when I went up there the first night on Sebastian's, first time on Sebastian's night, and I terrified, really.
Yeah, really.
But just told my first joke, everybody laughed. And then I realized that they'd actually come there to laugh.
Yeah.
And they maybe had a drink or two. And so suddenly I started doing stand-up. And then you get called back and...
Right.
And so, well, like, how much material do you think you've got now after like 3.5 years, 4 years?
Altogether, yeah. Maybe a like really good stuff like that. If I were to try to do it all, maybe an hour.
Yeah, brilliant. What kind of
stuff? But I wouldn't be able to memorize it all in one go.
Yeah, that's hard.
I'd have to do like 10-minute bits and then cut.
Yeah, it's really hard to remember the whole hour and to turn it into a story.
It's hard to remember 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's hard to remember 10 minutes. But imagine like going all over the whole hour and you've got to like sort of build it into a story and then have like a conclusion and a climax near the end, you know, that has to be some sort of story over the whole hour.
Yeah, I like stories, and so do you.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You basically, I gotta confess, you were the guy that I was like, okay, I want two things. I want to be as good as him, and I want him to like me. You were just the funniest guy, still are. By the way, listeners, I don't know how modest he's been about this, but Luke is the funniest guy on the whole stand-up Paris scene in English, by the way.
Wow, that's very flattering.
So well, I didn't say that so he'll call me back on the podcast.
Well,
so you were the guy we wanted to be as good as.
Yeah,
and
really?
I remember there was one bit there were some things because it was Sebastian Marx. I mean, I already had the comedians that I liked and had in mind, mm-hmm. and obviously a lot of us have the same heroes in comedy. But you I realized you did the same thing I did, as opposed to some of the other comedians who tell jokes, who
right.
actually have a little setup. You feel the setup, and there's that little twist at the end. You're like, oh, yeah, good one. And it's like, good one.
Yes. Yeah.
And you and I do more of the storytelling kind, where it is a story. And and there's these sort of moments along the way that are funny.
Right, yeah.
I'm not even sure how they actually work. I've never deconstructed them. Like, here's the setup. But there's always a setup and a punchline.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's more like you create a world, and then you can just keep making jokes in that world, but the audience understands the bizarreness of the world.
But it's
to begin
sort of
with.
Like you have to set up a situation, and the momentum of that situation just carries over into sort of jokes, you know?
Right.
Like it just, I don't know. It's
well, if your setup is a world, then anything you say within that world becomes a punchline.
Yeah. 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 That's right.
I think I'm thinking about how we do it. I think that seems to be what's going on. I wouldn't, but again, we just tell these things that people have been laughing at.
Yeah.
And you try it out on stage and then you do it, a few times and then you realize, okay, that works better if I do it this way. And
I came up with a routine about Star Wars that I did like the other week. And I'm not doing it on the podcast, but I've been trying to write this thing and I've got about 10 minutes on Star Wars and I've managed to make it so it's not about Star Wars. You know,
oh, it's not.
Really
it's about your family life back home that you left before you came to Paris.
Yeah, yeah. It's about that sort of thing.
Explains why you're here.
anyway,
no, it's really good. It's you set fun. Up a world, and then, but it's okay. It's like okay, take my world when I was a kid, but I'm Luke Skywalker.
Right.
I make fun of my upbringing and moving around in order to explain the whole I'm Dutch, but this is how I talk. This is my accent thing, and I do the whole. I was actually part of a secret spy family.
That's right. You've got this bit about...
living in the United States, growing up in New York and Washington, where I actually did.
Yeah.
But our mission was to stop the United States from developing good cheese.
Right. Yeah. And it was a mission successful, I think.
Yes, yes. One of our most successful agents was a man called Kraft.
It's
worked out of Philadelphia.
Right.
But I do this whole thing like that we had these, like my sister and I had to sleep with or seduce various government officials. My parents might have made a few disappear in order to get certain laws passed that they had to be served in these individual slices.
Right.
The cheese.
Yeah.
And the Americans totally fell for that because of that whole individualism thing.
Right.
And they had to be put in little body bags because it's dead. It's not real. Whereas French cheese, if you do a time lapse of it, it moves around. You can see it like having a discussion with the other cheese on the same plate.
French cheese has got a consciousness, you know.
Yeah, if you look away and you look back, it's moved.
A good piece of French cheese has got a personality.
Each variety does.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so you talk about being Dutch and being a member of a spy family.
I try to get that out of the way.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that if I were to tell my actual life that it's not funny, it's more like, wow.
But what do people often think about the Dutch? You know, when they know you.
Nothing. They don't really know much about the Dutch. What do they know?
Well, it's the usual things, right?
Well, that's the thing.
It's the stereotypes.
We do the Great British American Comedy Night,
uh-huh.
which is in Paris, France.
Yes.
And every one of those countries has got something. You know?
Right.
I mean, the Americans went to the moon and then drove a car around. I mean, who's going to beat that, right? The British, they're so great. It says great in Great Britain.
Yeah.
They were so great they had to just Brexit the fuck out of here because we weren't
We're too great.
But we're all speaking English because of them, so they got that. The French have their revolution that led to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and cheese for everybody.
Right.
But the Dutch, we got what? We got weed. Mm-hmm. Right? Ooh, that's the place where they can smoke weed.
Mm-hmm.
They got some windmills.
Windmills.
No idea what a windmill actually does.
Is that connected to the weed?
I don't know.
Is that like a filtration?
Is that where they mill the weed into that?
Like I thought maybe it's like a filtration system for the whole country.
I don't know. I don't know what windmills. I guess they milled stuff.
They milled. They use the wind in order to mill.
They don't teach us at a certain age how to run them.
No, they don't work. Do they? They're not working anymore.
I think some do. Yeah, I imagine just for fun and right. Also might as well mill something while you're at it.
So people think of like weed and windmills and tulips,
bicycles, tulips. Red light district.
The red light. So yeah, the red light district.
That's what I bring to the table.
Okay.
So I mean,
you're quite a good guy to have around at a party, to be honest. You know, any good party will have a Dutch guy in the corner, bringing all of those.
All of this, just providing all this.
Yeah, providing all of those things at a good party. Yeah, so that's not a bad. It's not a bad.
No, it's a good passport to have because if ever there's a hostage situation, it's always women and children and Dutch people off the plane first. You know? Nobody really cares about the Dutch. In France, they have a. When I first arrived at this ad agency where I was working, we're still young enough where people, where the other guys kind of fuck with you, they tease you, you know, just for, hey, new guy and everything. And all they had, my nickname for my last name is Van Walsum, the nickname was Van Houten.
Van Houten?
Van Houten, Van Houten, which is, do you know this thing, this product? In France, it's a chocolate powder. So that's all they had on me. It was like, hey, guy from the country where the chocolate powder is from.
He's a chocolate powder guy. Yeah, it's quite cool.
Yeah, I guess.
But it's cool to be the chocolate powder guy. Yeah, hey, man, it's the chocolate powder guy.
Yeah. Painters, though, people know that Holland has painters.
Painters. Right? Van Gogh.
Van Gogh. Even the first G is H, so it's Van Gogh. I'm so out of practice. I got to actually. Van Gogh.
Van Gogh. Can you speak some Dutch for us?
Ja, maar wat zeg ik dan? Ik weet nooit wat ik in deze situaties moet zeggen. En er zijn niet genoeg woorden met ge erin.
Wie genoeg woorden met ge? What?
I don't know. Basically said I don't know what to say in Dutch because, you know, what am I going to say?
So. Okay. That was amazing.
Yeah, it was a lot. It's a strange, but still, who can
that,
see?
You know what?
It's Klingon.
It's so rare that I hear Dutch.
It's Dothraki. I think more people speak Dothraki than Dutch.
Yeah. It's so rare that I hear Dutch, I have to say it, that it sounds like a language from Star Wars. Back to Star Wars. Always back to... You've got a picture of Darth Vader on the wall there.
Yes.
With
framed.
It's a framed picture of Darth Vader on Alex's kitchen wall. And... It's signed by Darth Vader. He's got a signed picture of Darth Vader on the wall. Yeah.
And sometimes
frame.
People ask me, was that the real Darth Vader? And yeah. I said, what does it matter?
How did you manage to get a signed picture of Darth Vader?
It looks like something that I've still had since the 70s, but I found it online in high resolution and I sent it to this online framing company. I said, here, frame this thing. And they sent it to me.
Okay, so it's actually a print.
It's not really signed, but it looks like it. Like
but
it
someone out there on the internet managed to get Darth Vader's signature.
Exactly. So it might be the real one from the actor who played him or some guy who's just standing around for this event.
Would you like my signature?
And it's not the signature of the actor. It actually says Darth Vader in a signature-y, autography kind of way.
It's like a celebrity signature.
But it just
like,
says Darth Vader.
You know, and it's kind
and
of
it's
like,
diagonally across a
can
across
I help
a corner.
You? And it's like, can I have your signature, Mr. Vader? There you go, little Johnny. And then it's kind of like a sort of, if Darth Vader was a celebrity,
yes.
That's what his signature would look like. It's kind of like modern art in a way. I was going to ask you some other things about... living as a Dutch person, you lived in America for a long time, you live in France. Do you feel more European or more American?
Well, I came to Paris definitely with a can-do attitude in a ce n'est pas possible culture.
Right. What do you mean by that?
I remember that at work, no one had told me that I'm first supposed to say how hard it is going to be to do this thing they asked me to do. I just would say, okay, I'll do it. because I thought, you know, growing up in the United States, going to American schools,
yeah,
even university, I thought that's what you got to do.
So what, they give you a job?
Yeah.
And you go, sure, I'll do it.
Yeah, whereas the French or the Parisians or whatever, places I worked in first had to go, oh, la la, that's going to, you know, what's the deadline? Oh, that's going to be hard. You know, there's the weekend and the pont. And
yeah,
there's always something. But that's just their way of dealing with it.
Right.
It's like meditation for Parisians.
Whereas in America, they'd be like, can you do that? Hey, Bob, can you do this job for me? And Bob's right. Like, sure thing.
Yeah.
You got it.
So I would always say yes and then figure out later how. So that was actually my secret weapon to any like success I had at work.
Yeah.
I would just kind of leap ahead by saying, sure, I'll do it. That was one thing. So I kind of came here with that American thing. But then after a few years of frustration with, I remember one time I went to downstairs from the office. This was before the internet. You had to go get a newspaper. And I went downstairs to this press place where they had the International Herald Tribune, mm-hmm, and Newsweek, things in English. I wanted some media in English.
Mm.
And you go down at your lunchtime and you go to the place and it's closed because he's off at lunch.
Right. Yeah.
I'm like, this would be the most. And I saw him, I waited, you know, I did something else and went and had lunch myself and then went back to the place and I asked him, listen, because I was annoyed by it. I was like, dude, I couldn't understand it. I was like, dude, wouldn't you stay open during that hour?
Yeah, that peak hour.
So that all those people, this was in Levallois, you know, they had the new modern buildings, but they also had the old little village still, mm-hmm, sort of there. And this was a part of that old part. And I was like, don't you want to, all these people spilling out of those buildings at lunchtime to potential customers. And he says to me, mais j'ai droit au déjeuner aussi, hein? You know,
I have to have lunch as well.
No, but it was droit. I have a right to lunch as well. And I'm like, wow, that just, I could just trace that back all the way to the French Revolution. It's just some kind of a mentality with them. Mm-hmm. Or even Asterix and the Romans. It's just sort of a...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of like holding on to your rights and sort of standing up for your rights.
And that was more... His right to have lunch was more important too. So after a while, I started, you know, if you can't beat him, join him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read somewhere that the French work the least hours in the world of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's not a bad thing to be number one in. Unless you own the company.
Right.
But if you don't... If you're not the boss, and you're working, then any benefit like that in your favor, I can understand why you would be totally for that and not want to go do it the American way or the British way.
Right,
why would you?
So and if you've done business in the UK as well,
yes.
What have you noticed from the Brits?
Adorable.
Yeah, really.
With the complete capability of just doing the complete opposite thing afterwards.
Right.
Everything is love.
Right. I mean, it's like, yeah, sure.
Fabulous.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, great. Sounds brilliant. Sounds good.
Yeah.
And then we're like, actually, I'm not sure we can do that.
No, but very, very professional. Very, just a whole other level. Get things done. They're very good. I love working with them.
Pragmatic.
Yeah. It's great.
It's like, right, let's get down to business.
Yeah. And it's great. But then afterwards, when we go to the pubs and things, or even just at work, and we talk about the continent, they would say the way they talk about Europe is like it's another place. They were like, so how are things over in Europe?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was even way before any of this Brexit stuff. It was just they just saw us as a different place.
Yes, it's always been like that. It's always been very much a relationship where we are separate from the rest of Europe because of that geographical thing. And so it's just. And also the Second World War reinforced it as well,
mm-hmm,
because, you know, there was that Battle of Britain and we never got invaded. And so we were like cut off from the mainland and, you know, stuff like it's just enough distance. And also there's the Norman invasion and other things. And so, yeah, we've always physically been separate. And so the question of whether Britain is part of Europe is really one about ideas. You know, it completely is about the concept of what Europe means to you and whether or not you want to be a part of it. And that kind of determines how a lot of people feel about all of the other issues. So if they just basically don't really want to be part of Europe, then they'll just make up their mind that Europe, the European Union is like full of all these laws and it's 75% of laws and all our money goes to it and it's undemocratic and stuff. It's just going to inform all of your opinions. And then because of that confirmation bias of like, if that's your opinion, every bit of information, you will consume it to support your opinion, because it can be basically taken in a number of ways, and you're just constantly confirming the thing you believe in both directions, probably. So, but, you know, I tend to agree with the idea that we should be part of Europe, and that Brexit's a bit of a dangerous mistake that's not potentially going to pay off for us for a long time. And, you know, it could hurt communities like Sunderland, for example, where there's a big Nissan factory. If they pull out of Sunderland, then, you know, thousands of jobs are going to be lost. And yet in Sunderland, they were one of the first places to vote out. They voted leave. But, it's, you know, it could potentially really be bad for them. You know, very weird decision-making. So, but I don't agree. I think that we should be part of it.
There's a sign of their reluctance to be part of it when you take the Eurostar. Uh-huh. And you go
train,
through
the train,
right? The Eurostar is a train that goes through the Channel Tunnel. It's very convenient. Mm-hmm. You can get from Paris to London two hours and 16 minutes or something.
Yeah.
And you go but Europe is not Britain is not part of Schengen, the thing where with the open borders between European countries. Mm-hmm. So you show your passport when you leave France, which is a normal thing. You just kind of wave it at them. They see it's a European passport and you leave.
Yeah.
They flip it open and go, oh, okay, there it is. It's valid.
Mm-hmm.
And then you walk 10 meters and there's another, like you've just teleported across.
Yeah.
There's another setup with two more border guys. Mm-hmm. And they're British.
Yeah.
With their whole British uniform, the British typeface.
Yeah. It's like, all right, mate, you're in Britain now. And give us your passport.
And they put the passport control in France rather than on the island itself, which I think says a lot.
We've got like a front in Calais. Because, you know, the Hundred Years' War.
Right.
That ended. You know how that ended? It ended when Britain, England had to retreat to Calais. And I think the war was decided by whoever got Calais. You know, whoever got Calais lost the war. Because, like, Calais is a bit... It's not exactly the best part of France. So, it's kind of, you know, whoever ended up with Calais was the loser. And that's what happened to England. I feel like we've got, like, a little front there with, like, guys behind tables or something. You know? Right. Just there in Calais. I don't know quite... But it's a dodgy area now because, you know, there's lots of... camps of migrants, you know, waiting to try and get into the UK, and it's like...
I don't know, it's terrible.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's another example of, like, keep it all off our island.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like dogs. They still have the quarantine thing?
Where animals, if you bring animals? I suppose so, so. And, you know, a lot of people were concerned about the Channel Tunnel, you know, bringing...
How they set up that humans can go through, but not a single rodent.
Right,
tried to reassure the public when they opened it. Yeah. There's this fear of rabies.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I understand that if rabies was a problem and Britain managed to eradicate it, mm-hmm. that then you wouldn't want to do everything you can to not bring it back, especially rabid dogs. But the impression they might have is that the continent is just
full of rabies.
With rabies.
Just full of rabies. It's just rabid dogs on every corner. You
know, it's not even an occasional thing. Like, oh my God, we found a rabid dog in Paris. It never...
No, it's just everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the armored cars on the way to work.
No, that's not a thing.
Yes, it's bizarre, isn't it? It's bizarre. That's okay. I was going to ask you about working in France again.
All right, so the language thing with doing business in France is when I see the Americans and the French, or any English-speaking people with the French tend to, because there's so many words that are similar... Mm-hmm. They tend to just sort of go, and I admire them for it. They just go ahead and they speak that English and they just use those words like what we call les faux amis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How would you explain les faux amis?
Yeah, false friends.
False friends. Like these words are, they look the same, but they have different meanings. And like, for example, militant, mm-hmm. militant.
Yeah.
Like a French person can be really militant about getting your business.
Right.
Right. They'll say that in a meeting. I'm very militant about getting your, you know, working for you.
Right. They don't realize the violence.
To an American, suggests. militant is ISIS. Militant right. is just a paramilitary people with Kalashnikovs and everything. So there's words like that.
A Toyota pickup truck.
Yeah, the militants, exactly. It's not militant, you know, but you can have militant, French protesters can be militant.
Right, I see.
But they're not militarized.
They're not driving around in like light blue Toyota pickup trucks with yeah. Rocket launchers.
So I sometimes wonder how, and in all these misunderstandings that they have, because, and it's the same the other way too. The Americans will say, when they speak a bit of French, they'll mm-hmm. throw in those words that sound the same. So I've often wondered how many billions of dollars and euros have been lost by misunderstandings in meetings yeah. where they've ended up, I don't want to work with these people because of someone who didn't learn the English enough
yes.
through Luke's English podcast.
Did you know that the French, when they write numbers, right? Like if you write 10,000 in French, you do 10, comma,
right.
000 dot, no?
Yeah, exactly. The dots are commas.
Wait a minute.
They put a dot instead of a comma. Where we would put a comma,
they put a dot.
A decimal period dot.
Yeah.
Whatever.
That's it, yeah.
So again, how many billions, well, millions at least, three, no, thousands, well, three, yeah.
Lots of money. Lots. In any case, it's a large amount of money, yeah. Because like, wait a minute, how do you write 10,000 as a French person? 10.000.
And yeah. then to make things even confusing, a comma, little comma, zero, zero,
zero, zero. Exactly. Whereas in English, it's like 10,000.00. So it's like wildly different number in both cases, like this ridiculously different number. One sort of faulty looking low number and a huge number. Difference. What about customer service, right? Because in Japan, for example, the customer is God in Japan.
Right.
And you get like this incredible service. They bow to you when they give you your shopping. When they give you the change, they hold their hand under your hand so that if any coins drop, they can catch them. And it's like very, very respectful. When you walk into the store, everyone in the shop welcomes you to the store. Inashamasen!
Right.
With this sound, this, I don't know what they say, but every time you walk into a big shop, it's like, Shamasen!
Yeah.
So it's amazing. The customer is God. But in France, it's kind of different, right? I wonder if Japanese tourists sort of find it difficult sometimes adjusting to the cultural difference, because I feel like they're almost completely opposite in some ways, Japan and France. I sense that there's a huge difference. What about customer service in France, in your opinion?
I think the French sometimes confuse service with servitude. Mm-hmm. They're worried that, you know, if they extend too much service, they're somehow losing status or something.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an American British customer is king kind of customer service that they come here and expect. And I've seen this happen where
Americans come.
Yeah, where Americans come to walk into a place like the bar we were in downstairs, which is a very authentic French thing, mostly French people, some locals and everything. Mm-hmm. And the person behind the bar is French. And there used to be a much grumpier old lady behind the bar, and she just refused service to people, Americans, who would come in and not say bonjour, monsieur, or madame.
Yeah.
And that's the key. That's all you have to do. Once you do that, they'll give you free drinks at one point. You know, you just come in and just get that right, and everything's fine. Yeah. But a lot of Americans go in, or Brits go in with maybe high.
Yeah.
Or not just, even.
Well, they wander in. What Brits would do, they'd wander in and say, hello, good evening. Two, table for two. Can we have a table for two? Dinner. Can we eat dinner? Yes.
That still might get you better service because at least you went with good evening.
Yeah, I suppose.
Whereas,
but you know, it has to be the French. Bonsoir, bonjour.
And especially monsieur or madame, that's where you get the free drinks.
Right.
That's just sort of that just sets you apart from the few extra syllables and you're set apart. But Americans, I sometimes see them walk into a place, and it's not their fault because they're conditioned by this in those places where you walk into a place and there's pictures of the food and even good places, but you walk up to the counter.
Yeah.
And there's a word. It's like a compound word. I call it, can I get a...
Yeah, can I get a? Yeah,
can I get a? That's not a. So I'm telling all your. If you hear this in popular culture, people and your listeners, don't say can I get a,
right?
And probably not in Japan either. It's just, And if you just walk in and say, can I get two pints or whatever?
Can I get a Coke? And can I get a hamburger?
Without
fries?
The hello, bonjour. And it's not even, there's a, it's weird. It's hard to explain, but you got to say, bonjour, monsieur, bonjour, whichever one applies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They'll say the same thing. They'll reply. Mm-hmm. And then you got to wait a beat. And they'll say, what can I do for you? Or je vous écoute, which is, I'm listening.
Mm-hmm. I'm listening. It's so cool. That's so cool. I'm listening.
Or they just, it's, but no, usually if you go in with the whole monsieur, madame thing, and then you're ready, and they, qu'est-ce que je peux faire pour vous, whatever, suddenly you're in, and it might take a little bit more time, but then the whole rest of the exchange is much more...
smooth and
yeah,
fine.
It's, and it's that can I get at is to be avoided. You can't just go in and... And because they go in, and sometimes they'll think, well, I'm going to go take my business elsewhere. I'm like, where? So you're going to go somewhere else, it's going to be the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just figure somehow we come here, and I felt it for years. It's like that they're doing it wrong.
Uh huh. So it can feel.
But we're from that whole new culture, that whole customer is king thing. That's someone at headquarters who decided, okay, guys, customer is king, and everybody started doing it. But it's not a natural law.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's how, you know, like French people, they kind of meet like, I imagine old, like Stone Age tribes would encounter each other with a certain like, okay, who are you guys? You know, it's not like, hi, have a nice day right away.
Sort of formality level.
Yeah, just sort of like who are these guys?
Yes.
Are they going to kill us? Who's going to evolve? What's the, you know,
everything's on sort of diplomatic tender hooks. Yeah. Kind of.
And I figure they have a longer life expectancy here. This whole kissing thing that they do after a while. Like, you have to kiss men in France after, what is it, we decided, we came down to, I think Paul Taylor came down to six months is the thing?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
So after 6 months, if you're getting along with a French friend, and French friendships always just, they just get better. It's, you know, it just always starts kind of like when dogs meet and it's all kind of, and then they kind of sniff each other out, and then as you're just rolling around friends for life. So you're after 6 months, suddenly he'll lean in and give you a kiss on the cheeks.
Don't freak out. Don't panic. Don't freak
panic.
Out.
I just figure that's okay. And you know what? That's kind of sweet. And I guess that whatever a country has been doing or a city has been doing for 2,000 years and another 10,000 years of people living here who didn't even know they were Parisians yet.
Yeah.
If they've been kissing on the cheeks, maybe it's some kind of immunosystem boosting thing that helps us live longer, along with the wine and the soft cheeses and whatever else is.
Yeah, don't question it.
I figured maybe they're doing it right rather than eating, you know, food with our hands from can I get a places.
Yeah, like Kraft cheese slices individually wrapped, as we were talking
exactly.
about earlier.
Maybe they're doing it right, and I kind of came here with that whole, you guys are doing it wrong, but actually, maybe yeah.
In your stand up, you do this bit about how you deal with a problem in a sort of French customer service situation. I think it's my favorite bit that you do. And it's just that idea of like when you go in, let's say you go into a place like I have it in the post office near where I live. So the post office in Pigalle, right, which is like near the Moulin Rouge. That's in my opinion, the worst of the area. I don't know why, but it just...
I think half your audience just went, oh, Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow.
You go to the Moulin Rouge, walk by it every day.
Oh my God, yeah. I live near the Moulin Rouge. That's right. So what was I saying? I was saying...
Sorry, going to the post office?
Going to the post office. And it's always like a problem. There's always just this incredible atmosphere in there. And it's always moody. And you go in and like, I get the impression that the staff are basically just saying no to every person who comes up. They're like, mon nom, c'est pas possible, you know, that
right.
thing.
Right.
And that's what you talk about, of how you break down that c'est pas possible kind of treatment that you get sometimes, which is where the first encounter is quite sort of difficult. And then there's a whole other stage after it. And there's a way of unlocking the French.
Right.
And sort of
French whispering.
French whispering, exactly, like the horse whisperer, the Robert Redford film. So French whispering. I should name this podcast French Whispering with Alexander Van Wolsen. That should be the name of your one-man show if you do one.
All right.
The French Whisperer.
I thought of that, yeah.
Yeah. It's a very good bit. What's the key to unlocking a French person when they say it's not possible?
Give it a second.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just means it's not possible for him at that moment right there.
Right.
Then you make a bit of a French face and go, oh, pas possible. Mm. Show some, I guess,
complicity.
Try to create complicity. Mm-hmm. Just give it a second.
Yeah. Like, oh, that's difficult.
And then he might say, normalement, on fait pas ça. Mm-hmm. Bon. Normalement. Normally, we wouldn't do this.
And you're like, ooh.
And then you'd go, oh, oh, you know, more French face and
yeah,
kind of, yeah, wow. Because it's so pas possible, right? This, yeah, I totally understand.
Yeah.
And then they might, the next level is, je vais voir ce que je peux faire.
Ah.
Okay, I'm going to see what I can do.
Ah. You're thinking, hello?
And then eventually, you know, there's a few more steps. Maybe goes to the computer.
Yeah.
Looks at the screen, looks totally pas possible on the screen.
That's the bit that I like, I have to say. This is the when you start talking about...
the manager?
Yeah.
There's a manager, got to talk to the manager. He's got, turns around, he's got just years of bad possibility on his face. But eventually you get it. It comes up, comes back, and he says, you know, exceptionally, mm-hmm. you get what you came for, plus the free cheese we were talking about.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, great. And that's at the post office, they get free cheese.
Even at the post office, they have a little fridge in the back where they, well, actually, no, it's not even a fridge because it's under that glass dome, so it can right. be just at the right...
Yeah, the perfect optimal
gooey temperature.
Yeah, that's right. It's that dome of cheese that you have. Not they don't have cheese domes at the post office, but they could. You know, I don't think anyone would complain.
But they have a lot of other stuff at the post office.
Yeah.
They like banking and like all sorts of, you know, it's a weird thing. There's two things. And it's open later. There's like the tabac, which for some reason you can get all sorts of other things like metro tickets and stamps for official things. Yeah, and then there's the post office. They're like... sort of
they're actually quite good like when you a good post office in Paris is like decent, you know, a good well-run tightly run post office in the heart of Paris somewhere, you know, it's like you can go down there, get something done, send a package today with the post office but not the one that I go to where everything's just like no
but to our American listeners they already speak English. So I guess
They do.
But anyone,
I do have listeners in America.
But some living over there, there's a national sort of making fun of the post office thing. Mm-hmm. It's just like the worst place in American pop culture.
Yeah, really?
If you work there, you're certain, you know, it's like the DMV.
What's the
Department of Motor Vehicles.
Oh, yeah?
And the post office. It's often the butts of... or references and comedians joke, oh, I had to go down to the DMV and everybody knows what that means.
Right.
You know, I went to the post office and I'm like, oh, there's like, but it seems there's more respect for the post office in Paris. It's like a real job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, I guess we should wrap up this conversation then. How do you feel at this stage in proceedings? We've been talking for about 50 minutes.
Awesome.
Has it gone being on Luke's English podcast? How has it been?
I hope it went well.
Yeah.
For a first podcast, it was fun to, with you as usual. It felt like we were just talking like we usually do and to other people at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So good. Are you on stage soon?
This weekend at the Great British American Comedy Night. Hosting
it.
Yeah.
Oh,
this Saturday.
Okay. Where is that then?
That's at the Sogymnase Comedy Club.
Yeah. Okay. Boulevard Bonne Nouvelle.
Just right by the Bonne Nouvelle Metro.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
In that big building, the Théâtre du Gymnase. Go... enter to the left, four flights up, and we're actually in the little attic of the gymnasium.
Yes, not the main theater. The building itself is like this beautiful, grand old theater with like holds. I don't know how many people, like 400 people or something.
Yes.
And upstairs, there's like this little sort of little sort of attic room.
Yeah,
holds about 60 people.
I think the maximum with all the little stools was 175 or something.
75
standing room only kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know where the Jamel Comedy Club is for any Parisians living here. The Jamel Comedy Club is this place right next door where there's a big line for people usually waiting to get in. Our place is the one where there's no line. So
that's right.
Come check it out.
It's next to the most successful stand-up comedy venue in town.
And especially come see Luke. It's really good.
Yeah. Well, looking forward to seeing you again on stage soon. Alex, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun to have you on. I'm very glad that this has been your first ever podcast. And I hope that you should do your own. You should start your own podcast.
Okay.
You know,
and teach them.
No, you could just
do some whispering.
Just do the French Whisperer podcast.
Yeah, right.
How to survive French culture, like a 10-part series. Mm. That would do very well. Mm. You should think about it.
Sounds like a good idea.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Cheers.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
So that was Alex Van Walsum. And that was good fun, that episode. I really enjoyed it. It was nice to sit down with Alex and kind of pick his brains about all of the things you heard about, essentially. I mean, he's lived in so many different places and he's got experience of so many different cultures that he's very worldly, you know. And so he's got lots of things to say. If you're in the Paris area, you can see Alex on stage doing stand-up comedy in English. He's a regular performer in the on the Paris scene at the usual places, you know, like at the Pan Am Art Cafe, the Saut Gymnase, and various other places. So that's pretty much it. I look forward to reading any comments that you have or responses or questions or whatever on the page for this episode. But that's enough for this one. Thanks for listening, and I'll speak to you again soon. Okay, then? Good. All right, then. I'm going to say goodbye now, and I'm going to do it using my voice, which is the thing I'm using to talk to you, right here at the end of the episode. 50 minutes of podcast. It's good, isn't it? It's a good round number. Yes, it is. All right, then. Thanks for listening again. Shall I keep going? No, I won't. I'm just going to say goodbye. So here it is. Goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.